Okay, sorry. Thank you very much.
So, I and most of the foreigners and many of the Japanese reporters who have gone to school abroad are very pleased with what she is trying to do. But the bigger problem is, as I was saying earlier, the whole newspaper industry is just in flux. And one of the things that I was wondering during the summer, I'm watching 2,000 journalists run around like mad men and women throwing the conference, basically all writing the same thing because we had such limited access. And I'm thinking to myself, why are we doing this? Mm-hmm. I mean, seriously, the bloggers are downstairs, each and every NGO, and sometimes they have better contacts than me, of course. I mean, the really big NGOs can just pick up the phone, and I'm kidding you not, because I saw this happen, they can call Gordon Brown, or they can call Angela Merkel and say, Oxfam or Greenpeace can go, you know, this. What's going on here? What was decided today? Boom, boom, boom. And we can't do that. So they put it on their blogs, and then you've got all the journalists checking all the blogs of all the NGOs, and then putting it back on and going out.
Yeah,
I mean, it's ridiculous when you think about it. It doesn't make any sense. So one of the things that I plan to do over my holiday when I have free time is I'm supposed to write up a very long report on the summit and on how the media at the summit worked and how the NGOs worked, and send it to Yukiko and basically say, look, this is the current reality, technology-wise, that we're facing. And if we're going to get readers, if we're going to get dedicated readers, we're going to be competing with these blogs and all these other people. So we got to figure out how to respond to that. And that's, I think that's really a big challenge for the future, at least for getting news out. But, well, again, we can talk about what kind of feature articles you all would be interested in. Because I think that's the kind of thing that really much would distinguish the JT. So, what should we do? Begin?
Well, I think we can start now.
So, it's raining out.
It's raining out?
Oh, yeah.
Torrential
downpour.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't I just go ahead and run through this, then if people come in, you know, we can.
There's one more person coming.
Go ahead, yeah, sure. Any questions before I begin? That's fine.
Said it's a public company.
Yes.
But they're running a business that's losing money.
Yes.
Where do the shareholders stand then? Like, well, it's not in the shareholders' interest.
Right. Well, that's.
So why are they doing it?
Basically a sense of altruism, I think.
Yeah, but what are the other shareholders? They're okay with it?
They're basically okay with it because this is just my personal opinion, but I think that with the Japan Times, NIFCO is not just an auto parts manufacturer, but they're also a newspaper publisher, which means the chairman, the president, they get to have private lunches with the foreign minister, they get to meet Johnny Depp and Robert De Niro in Tokyo, they get to live the high life, whereas without the Japan Times, they're just another auto parts company.
Yeah, so. But the shareholders, they don't care about that.
No, they do care about that because it's good. They see it as good free publicity, actually. Mm. So,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's value added, I think.
I guess it's a media, so they can, with politics, a bit of sway, maybe.
Right, yeah. Whenever
they're the chairman. They're not meant to, but.
Yeah, whenever there's policy affecting the auto industry, or for example, the big thing right now is clean technology. How is the Japanese government going to promote it? Are they going to put money into R&D, that kind of thing? And all of the communities that are discussing it, all the information, is something that each and every auto parts company in Japan wants, as you might imagine. But NIFCO has a leg up because
so the newspaper might be losing company, but overall it might be making more money.
Overall, it might be making the company more money. Yeah, I would like to think so. but the parent company itself is doing extremely well. But the Japan Times, yes, is losing money. And it was my understanding that there was a certain level of money that we were allowed to lose and the board of directors would not complain. But anything above that level, we had to crack down. So again, the good news is we're in the provinces, places like Kyushu and Shikoku, we're up. So they're not quite, they haven't been quite as loud as they were 6 months ago. So hopefully we can keep it up. Any other questions?
So do we see an upward trend in subscriptions, etc.?
We are in West Japan, which is my part of the PPAC.
Especially
so,
on Tuesdays?
Tokyo's happy. But
especially on Tuesdays
no,
when your column comes out?
No, truthfully, the circulation is rising because they're making an effort to get into the schools and to get out to places where people don't learn English.
Right, so okay. That's
train stations and airports in Ohio.
I'm sorry?
Train stations and airports in Ohio.
That's something I want to talk to you about. How do we reach those people? How do we get to them? Who do we talk to? If anybody has any contacts, then by all means, pass them on. Because we have, right now for us, Hokkaido is terra incognita, real. I'm not in the sales department, I'm not in the distribution department, so I really don't know what efforts they've made up here to get them. But like I said, I've seen it all over Shinchitose Airport and a few hotels. But beyond that, I don't know. So. Well, let me just go ahead and run through this, and then stop me along the way if you have any questions or comments or complaints or anything like that. And again, this is all on the record, so afterwards, if you have any specific comments that you don't want on the record, come up to me afterwards and tell me, or go ahead and email me later. Of course, I ran out of business cards during a conference, but I'll make sure that each and every one of you gets one. Anyway, let's just run through this. So, basically, I want to talk about the Tohoku summit. What happened? Well, I hope that all of you followed the news, but basically, there were three major things, I think, that the media at least focused on. First was that the G8 leaders agreed on long-term greenhouse gas emissions reductions targets of at least 50% by 2050. It's not surprising. This is something that the Japanese government had pushed for quite some time, and certainly Fukuda himself was very keen on this. So there was a little bit of concern right before the summit because President Bush said that he wasn't sure the G8 was the appropriate forum in order to talk about climate change issues. But in the end, he agreed to go along with it. The thing that some people are saying is the big success of the summit and justifies all of the expense, all of the security, all of the traffic congestion, all of the problems that led up to the summit is the second goal. G8 leaders agreed to work to make the climate change conference in Copenhagen a success. In December of 2009, the United Nations will be in Copenhagen to hammer out a post-Kyoto Protocol treaty. The Kyoto Protocol expires in 2012. Within the discussions, one thing that has become a subject of controversy is by how much should the nations cut? The scientists say that in order to prevent a global warming catastrophe, which basically means over the next 10 to 15 years, planet Earth can't rise more than 2 degrees, average 2 degrees Celsius, otherwise we're in very big trouble. In order to ensure that doesn't happen, cuts of between 25% and 40% in current levels of greenhouse gas emissions need to be made by 2020, and 80% to 95% cuts need to be made by 2050. That's the general consensus of the scientific community. Now, politically, that's incredibly difficult to do a model. However, going into this, the question was, would George Bush, would Stephen Harper from Canada, who's also got some problems, would some other people try to block a statement from the G8 leaders committing to this climate change in Copenhagen being a success? The format of the G8 is such that nothing can be agreed on. I've got a copy of each and every one of the promises they made. None of this can be written down and distributed unless all leaders unanimously agree. And unlike, say, the Supreme Court of the United States, they don't publish minority dissents. So, in the end, they got this. If you're reading the Japanese language newspapers, you know that this was hailed as a huge success, and a lot of people in the Japanese government are quite happy. The third thing is the G8 leaders promised Africa that it would increase aid by $25 billion a year by 2010. This is following up on the 2005 summit at Gleneagles in the UK, when Tony Blair took the lead to commit to Africa along with Bono and Bob Geldof. Bob Geldof, by the way, was supposed to come to support him. However, he backed out. They did send Bill Nighy, the actor who appeared with Johnny Depp in Pirates of the Caribbean, and he's done some other films as well. So I think he was over at Unwoody Park on Monday doing something. So that's what happened. Now, what didn't happen? Well, first, the GA leaders failed to commit to the specific recommendation by climatologists of cutting the greenhouse gases, as I just mentioned. The second thing, and this is something the African NGOs really, really complained about the entire time, the GA leaders failed to explain how they would deliver on their aid promises made to Africa since 2005 at the UK summit, and how they would take responsibility for ensuring the money was accounted for. As you might guess, Africa is a bit of a mess when it comes to transparency and corruption. And those two issues were constantly brought up by the NGOs. And to be fair, the delegates, the European Union was concerned. The United States was concerned. Obviously, they want to know where the money, the taxpayer money, is going. The problem is that all this aid has been promised. In some cases, only 4% has gotten through. Nobody knows where a lot of it has gone and where it is. And what the African NGOs and what the African community had called for was the GA should use its own money to set up a watchdog organization to tell everybody how much money goes where and how it is spent. But the GA didn't want to do it this time for whatever reasons. What was on the Toyaco agenda? Well, a number of issues. There were kind of the three long-term issues, which are the first three: climate change, aid to Africa, and nuclear non-proliferation. Specifically, they're trying to get the nuclear non-proliferation treaty jump-started again. In 2005, there was a review conference of the treaty in New York, and it basically collapsed into chaos because nobody had an answer as to what you were going to do about states with nuclear weapons who didn't declare it, specifically India, Pakistan, and Israel. So with the non-nuclear proliferation issue, this time the focus was on Iran and North Korea, and both of those issues. They didn't really talk about it as much because climate change really dominated the agenda. I was in the press room, and it just seemed like every time I walked in there, it wasn't a G8 summit, it was a climate change conference, because you had booths on climate change. You had NGOs related to climate change. You had professors of climate change. You had anarchists talking about the end of the world because of climate change. So, but those were the three main issues that the Japanese government decided on by itself last September, I think, to keep on the agenda. The bottom four are fairly recent developments that were forced on the agenda by the other GA nations. The world food crisis, the price of oil, financial markets in the world economy, and Zimbabwe. The world food crisis was forced on the agenda by the Europeans and by the Americans. The price of oil was forced upon the GA by circumstance. Financial markets in the world economy essentially means trade, specifically making sure that the Doha round of negotiations comes to a successful conclusion. What's blocking that? Agriculture. Japan on rice, but other countries as well are moving fast to ensuring that their agricultural products are protected. And finally, the last was Zimbabwe. Now, this is an issue that, quite frankly, the Japanese government and some other governments, specifically I think the Italians, did not want on the agenda. Why? Because they didn't feel that the GA could A, do anything about the problem, and B, there was so much other stuff that was important to talk about that they felt they should draw a line. The British and the Americans pushed hard for Zimbabwe to get on the agenda, and in the end it was put on the agenda. Yesterday, I attended Gordon Brown's press conference, which was about 25 minutes. He's a very, very dry speaker, and he looks kind of like Lurch from the Addams Family, close. But he spent about, I would say, 10, 15 minutes talking specifically about Robert Mugabe. He's an illegitimate leader who has blood on his hands, genocide, blah, 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 blah. Then he talked about climate change in Africa and some of these other things. So all of these were discussed to various degrees in Toyoko, which meant that in any given moment you had massive chaos in the press room, 2,000 people running around trying to get statistics or information on any one of these seven things. So, was the summit a success? Well, I'm going to be interested to hear your opinions, but here's what they're saying over in the media center. Yes, say the GA leaders, surprise, surprise. and some elements of the Japanese media. Specifically, I'm sure some of you noticed the huge headlines earlier, world agrees to have emissions by 2050. That's slightly misleading. What the world agreed to was is that it would be a good idea to do that. So, was the summit a success? No, said practically everyone else. The NGOs held press conference after press conference after press conference after press conference over Kusutsu, and they basically delivered the same message. No, this was a failure. The German delegations I talked to, as well as the Brits, as well as the French, also privately off the record, said that the summit was a failure. The Americans, quite frankly, didn't really care because everybody's focused on the election. So, to be fair, though, a lot of the NGOs involved with Africa said it's kind of too early to tell. There did seem to be some progress. It seems like the GA is taking the idea of this watchdog organization more seriously, and that they are going to make efforts to make sure that the money gets to where it's supposed to be, but it's still an ongoing process. So I would say that they're neutral at this point. My own view is it was neither a success nor a failure. The purpose of the GA is simply to get together and form a gentleman's or a gentlemanly woman's agreement. It's not legally binding, it's merely politically binding. And because there is no separate organization to monitor and get back to each individual GA country each year, basically it's formal, but it's informal, I guess I should say. So did it do any good in the short term? Who knows? In the long term, who knows? Now, however, that said, there's some basic problems with the outcome that I think that the media picked up on and that I'd like to introduce here. On climate change, the GA leaders did not take into account the scientific evidence or the advice presented last year by the United Nations of rapid climate change and what the world needs to do. The emerging economies, I think, also failed to show political leadership and imagination, putting their own, quote, victim politics, unquote, above cooperation. There was a press conference by the G5 leaders, Kevin Rudd, whoever the Chinese leader came over, wasn't in power, plus the president of Brazil, plus a couple other people. And they released a statement in which they basically said that the history of the world shows that the G8 countries are responsible for most of the environmental pollution since the Industrial Revolution. That's true. But let's put that aside and take a look at the science. The scientists say that what's important is not the past, but the future. The world has to make some changes here. So it would have been appreciated, I think, certainly by the GA leaders, but also by the international community as a whole, if they had banged the drum a little bit less about colonialization being the victims of bad policy and offered some practical solutions. The second problem is on Africa. The GA leaders failed to explain or take action again on the promise they were actually delivered. They also failed to address practical concerns on the distribution of aid. We talked about that. Corruption to make sure it's the right people. So this didn't get as much criticism as the climate change deal did, but it was still fairly criticized. There's a third problem is there is in effect very little the GA can do with the rising price of oil. It was pointed out during the summit that you had a number of other nations here, but Saudi Arabia wasn't invited to Hokkaido. How can you possibly talk about the rising price of oil and not have Saudi Arabia here? So that was a big problem. The finance ministers had previously said they weren't sure about the role of oil speculators in the market. But this time, Robert Zeller of the World Bank, as well as some other people, said, we know that the speculators are driving up the price of oil, and we've got to do something about it. Right now, the IMF is supposed to meet in New York in September and issue a report. So the oil industry is watching what's going to happen with the IMF report in September. They're still saying it could go to $200 a barrel. But if the IMF comes out and says, speculators are responsible, and by God, we're going to do something about it, then you may see a drop of oil, which means those of you who drive cars might finally see the price of gas go down. The G8's energy policy promotes controversial fuels like biofuel and nuclear power, even as the leaders tacitly acknowledge biofuels are at least partially responsible for the current food crisis. This was a big issue with the Brazilians, it was a big issue with the Mexicans, and it was a big issue within some G8 countries. The European Union has come to the conclusion that biofuels in the current state are not sustainable. But the United States is still pursuing its own policy, and there was a great discussion on that. Nuclear power and non-proliferation issues are connected, but they got very little coverage and very little attention. I wrote a couple of stories. But whenever you're talking about Iran, whenever you're talking about North Korea, one of the first things that especially the Iranians will tell you is, hey, if Japan could build Bokashi and Aomori, why can't we build our nuclear power plants? We're following the IAEA rules, so what's the problem? So I would have liked to have seen this to have gotten more attention, but again, they had so many other things on the agenda that it was impossible. Silvio Berlusconi gave his press conference, which I attended briefly, and the first thing that he said was, this year, too much on the agenda. Next year, the G8 goes to Italy. We're going to keep it short, sweet, and simple, and not put all these other things on the agenda. So, that basically is, in a nutshell, my view of what happened at the summit itself and the main issues. Now, I want to turn to part two. This is a three-part series lecture today, and talk a little bit about Hokkaido and the Toyota summit. And here, I think I'd like to bring in your opinions and observations as well. So just jump in and stop with an observation or question as I go on if you want. I think you should all know, some of the reports in Tokyo Osaka said the economic impact of the Hokkaido summit would be as much as 60 billion yen, which apparently is also the estimated total cost of the summit. I don't know if that includes security or not. But the Times correspondent of the Times of London asked the Japanese government a couple of weeks ago how much it cost, and that's the figure they were given. This cost is 10 times the cost of of the G8 summit in England in 2005. Nearly 10 times. So
according to HBC, it's 70.
It's 70.
According to HBC, okay, this
so
is last week.
So, mm-hmm. Right, okay, so now you're probably 11, 12 times. Mm-hmm. However, I think that there was a sense of resignation among those living in the Toyoka area that few would benefit, but most would not. I came up here at the end of March. I was invited by the Hokkaido Shimbun to give a speech in Date on basically how the foreign media might see the summit, what they would do. And I spoke to a number of people in the local business community, as well as the mayor of Date, and basically they were just saying, hey, we know that we were lied to by Tokyo. We know that this is going to be a Tokyo production from start to finish. All we can really do is act like, this will be beneficial, and all we can do is just stand by and help out if we can. But I didn't talk to anybody in Date who was convinced they were going to become multimillionaires after the summit. So, and again, there was a sense of deja vu among people in other parts of Japan when they heard stories, again, in the Honshu media about how the central government had promised you all that you would play an active role in the summit and your businesses would prosper and that it would be good for Hokkaido and new infrastructure and the whole thing, only to see the Tokyo bureaucrats move in and basically just give out the stuff piecemeal to their buddies and shut out the local merchants. I've covered quite a number of conventions and conferences and whatnot in West Japan, as especially David there was. And each time I would go to these places, I would hear the same kinds of stories. But we thought we'd have a much more active role. And now it comes and it goes, and everybody's kind of left wondering what all the fuss was about.
Okay, so, jumping
yes,
in.
Ahead,
watching NHK reports every night at 7 o'clock, they kept on stressing how much the locals were getting. And this is both the local and national news. Mm-hmm. And basically, yakitori and foot baths. That obviously the fix was in.
Yeah.
Okay.
So people came to the International Media Center. And I don't know how much you saw the inside of the International Media Center on your television screens.
I did. Yeah.
You could have been in anywhere in the world. There was no sense at all in the center that you were in Hokkaido. They did. The Hokkaido Prefectural Government did have a very nice booth set up. They were giving away Furuno wine, and they were giving away sake. I did complain because Fred's beer wasn't there. I thought that was a huge mistake. I also thought it was a huge mistake that they didn't have just local merchants on the inside setting things up. They did try to do something which backfired in a major way. Somebody in the Hokkaido Prefectural Government managed to convince Kaido Sho that it would be a good idea on the second day of the conference to hold a big Genghis Khan party outside the press center. Now stop and think about this for a minute. You've got 2,000 people from all over the world with jet lag, working 16, 18 hours a day, who don't bathe, in a press room, smelly, and they're going to take time out of their busy schedule to go eat Genghis Khan, smell even better, and come back in the press room? No. So unfortunately, that didn't work out. And I don't know if this made the media, but I heard they threw away something close, about a ton of lamb was actually tossed. So. And the question we journalists were asking was, well, what's going to happen to all this food? Why not just give it to a food bank? And I had to explain to European journalists, acquaintances in Canadian and American, that, well, food banks and giving away that kind of thing, that idea hasn't quite caught on here to the extent it has elsewhere. There was a lot of waste. And as I was explaining before some of you walked in, the sole Hokkaido experience for probably 1,500 of the 2,000 journalists who were there, there are a few who are going to be traveling around Hokkaido, thankfully, was the sushi restaurant inside the media center. That was it. That was it. That's their experience of Japan. And, unfortunately, if Hokkaido was thinking this was a good opportunity to promote itself, it wasn't. Inside the media center, it felt like I was in anywhere in Tokyo or Osaka. Outside the media center, it was raining and cloudy and foggy for 3 days. So, unfortunately, that happened. So, but I'll be interested to hear your comments as well. So, and what I'd like to do now is turn it back on you all, because I don't want this to be just me up here. But I came with some questions for you all that I think are very important. Don't worry, I'm not going to write this up as an article. Embarrass you by putting your name in unless you want me to.
Go ahead.
But I guess my question is for you all as experts and longtime residents, does the Hokkaido government have a post-Toyoko plan and a budget for promoting international business, including trade and tourism? And if so, is it being funded by Tokyo, or are you picking up the bill? This is incredibly important, because in some of the conferences and whatnot that I've covered in, say, for example, Okinawa and Fukuoka, there was a post-plan. Yes?
Well, I would advise that first part of your sentence says the Hokkaido government have a post-Toyoko plan. Just take out post-Toyoko. Does the Hokkaido government have a plan? And a budget for promoting international business?
Do they? Can anybody answer that question?
My wife, who was born and raised here, wanted to write the GA leaders a letter saying, I hope you enjoyed your direct flights from your points of origin to the Shinchitose Airport.
Good morning.
Wouldn't it be nice if ordinary people like us could start our journeys and terminate them at the Shinchitose Airport without going through Naito or the consul? Mm-hmm. Salaries up here are 20% down from major sections of Honshu. And when you want to leave the country, you got essentially a 20% surcharge on. And then you got the fuel surcharge on top of that. Mm-hmm. I work at a university, and I'm proud to say I'm taking 9 students to the state of Virginia in August, and their parents are paying through the nose. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, is really the local economy being comparative in permanent recession here? Well, what can I do to my students to inspire them to take A, their English studies seriously as non-English majors, and B, to look beyond the shores of Hokkaido for another future? So I'd like to
have you raised these concerns at all with the governor, or has HIPA been in touch with local Chamber of Commerce officials to present these concerns? I mean, I'm sure you all have great ideas as to what needs to be done, but is anybody listening?
Well, a number of years ago, we had a wonderful gathering at the Renaissance Hotel where business leaders, Japanese business leaders, and Iwa business leaders, members of the oil and gas effort of Sakhalin, came together and had a hotel in Sapporo for an ideas exchange. And I think that was the last productive time where ideas such as this got any airspace.
Well, what about meeting with Nakagawa and Machimura? Because they represent this area, don't they? I mean, okay, maybe they're not big on human rights issues, but money is certainly a language they understand.
I think businesses lead in government. There are a conventional commercial business, but the government has always been very poor. All the people who actually live at the government were the government on super purposes. So I don't think you should really put any faith in the entire government being capable or having the willingness to do anything.
And what about the Hokkaido Chamber of Commerce and Industry? Do you
They are self-serving, but there are people in there who do things, and at the moment I understand they go overseas to do things, and some of those people are really all bring them to this point.
But from my experience, seems to be Japanese government on all levels doesn't want to put any money into tourism. They don't see that there will increase, you know, profits for companies and therefore increase their taxes and therefore the money will come back. They just don't do anything, it seems.
Mm. Despite the fact that there's huge numbers of Asian tourists coming into this part of Japan, despite the fact that Niseko is basically an Australian colony during the winter time.
The Japanese government, probably going to follow it. So yeah. They can take kudos for doing it. Mm-hmm. Nothing whatsoever.
No. Basically, the apathy from the Hokkaido government is deafening.
Yeah, it is. I mean, this Niseko boom, there's lots of tax being paid to the government, but they're actually returning nothing. Zero.
Yeah. Well, I live in Niseko, and on Sunday we had a nice, or all week we had a nice couple of buses parking our driveway, a place. And so there must have been something going on where routes were coming into Niseko, whether it was New Zealand, GA members, whatever, but there was a lot of buses, about every kilometer was buses of police going into Niseko.
There were 10 buses parked catty corner from my bar, and in you know, spirit of the whole eco theme of the G8, they kept their engines running all night.
Well, that was noticed, and that got reported in the international media.
Last year, Hiba held a meeting with the head of the Hokkaido Ministry of Economy and Trade.
Right.
And a lot of his speech just seemed to be based on traditional things, like how can we get more of Toyota, companies like that coming up here,
right.
or selling some of, you know, few of our agricultural products abroad.
It's sort of that thinking, that kind of...
The resource colony thinking,
yeah,
yes.
Construction.
So whenever you bring up things like eco-tourism or...
They don't even know what it is.
They're still stuck in the 60s and 70s.
Although, to be fair to the speaker, he did bring up, you know, some local Hokkaido businesses, and he did, you know, come up with how can Hokkaido get away from the colonial thing. So he wasn't totally off.
I don't know if the government in the States is any better, but certainly Australian government is not that peaceful. So basically what the line of business do.
Yeah, normally after these things, and this was the case in Okinawa as well, because I covered the Okinawa summit, they did have a post-summit plan for Okinawa, but they couldn't carry it out because they eventually realized two things. First, nobody was going to come to Resort Island where there were 17,000 U.S. Marines running around. But the second thing was, Okinawa's main tourist season, of course, is the wintertime. But you get a lot of bad weather. So if it's a question of paying, say, 70,000, 80,000 yen to go to Okinawa for 4 days, or going to just a few hours more to Chiang Mai or Thailand or Southeast Asia, apparently they said, well, people aren't going to go to Okinawa. So
they just gave up.
So they just basically gave up. They did approach, several resort, Club Med, I think, actually came and looked very hard at setting up a resort on Okinawa, you know, very close to Nago, and they just said, no, we can't get the return on investment we need. The Hilton has been approached any number of times by the U.S. government directly, including by, in one case, a former U.S. ambassador, and they just said, no, there's no potential here. So I can tell you the U.S. government, if they think it'll help bring business to Japan, and we're talking about big companies, unfortunately not people, entrepreneurs like Fred, but the Hilton and the Ritz-Carlton and those kind of guys, the U.S. government will get involved. So
And that's kind of my one of the things I wanted to talk to you all about are the various governments who have representative offices here in Hokkaido. I don't know how many consulates there are now.
Five.
But I certainly know the U.S. and the Australians have consulates. Are they making an attempt to talk to people like you and then to maybe talk to people in other countries and say, look, Hokkaido is a good investment for any number of reasons, A, B, C, D. Is there anything going on in that way, or is it?
The Australians are pretty active. They're sort of maybe looking at Seiko to see if they can copy what they're doing in other parts of Japan. Mm. So probably not good for the Seiko and for Hokkaido, but certainly not good from the Australian perspective. How there was a study last year, who does what, how do they do it, and can we copy this in other parts of Japan?
And what about my second question on international tourism? Because when I was here in March, the Hokkaido media was making a big deal about the governor going to Taipei, I guess, to drum up more Taiwanese tourists. But is it just performance? I mean, obviously the numbers are going up, so people are coming. But do they have a plan, or are they just kind of going with the flow?
They did one. They weren't sure if it was Hokkaido or Japan. They allowed Taiwanese to drive on Taiwanese licenses.
Oh.
Previously, Taiwanese couldn't drive on licenses. Licenses and couldn't rent cars in free travels.
Right.
So whether that was as a result of the government, I'm not sure. That should increase in free travels.
And road fatalities, yeah.
Yeah. And for the summit, or either before or after the summit, did they talk about how they plan to increase tourism? Is anybody in Hokkaido talking about increased flights, maybe not direct flights, but more flights to Narita so that people can come into Narita or Kansai Airport? Yeah.
So this is actually a Tokyo question, because the Hokkaido people don't have any power about the number of flights or the, this is really actually being blocked, I think, by Tokyo. Mm. Yeah. A lot of people talk about increasing things in Hokkaido, but you need to have the customs inspectors and visa inspectors at the airports, and Tokyo is really reluctant to change things as fast.
Sorry, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a subsidy for people that come up to Hokkaido. You can fly up to Hokkaido and get two nights in a hotel for the same price as a plane ticket. We don't get that deal, so if we fly down, you know. So two free nights subsidized by the Hokkaido government is still a domestic subsidy for people that are down south that have higher incomes already.
Yeah. I mean, I got round trip up here on the first night and the night at the Sunroot Hotel, right beside Sensipo Station, for 32,000 yen.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Sorry, Peter.
And just if I can just finish off real quick, the third thing I want to talk about is the English language medium post-Tokyo Summit of Hokkaido. I hope all of you are Japan Times readers, but if you're not, that's okay. We are talking, and we were talking before, we being not just the Japan Times, but also the Daily Yomiuri, then the IHT Asahi as well, is what really is the potential post-summit? But we do have the following concerns. Is there enough of a demand among visiting foreign business people here in Sapporo for an English language paper? I note that I don't think that you have an information language magazine yet. You had something there, Hokkaido Tracks, I think, which is now available. But that's the only thing I've seen.
How do we use
the hotels and pensions and foreigners are staying? And again, for me, as a journalist, what kind of news do you all want to read the most? I mean, my experience has been that you do need something other than just local news, because even if you're living in a place that's outside the Tokyo, you still want to know what's going on in the world. So what kinds of story ideas and whatnot, so feel free to propose those. But at this point, I think I can say with some confidence that we in the English language media came to Toyoko, and all we heard was potential, 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 potential. Hokkaido, beautiful weather, great summers, wonderful winters, except for Sapporo, not really that much snow. And that's the other thing that the local officials in Toyoko kept emphasizing, is that it's the warmest place in Hokkaido during the winter. It was something that we heard over and over and over again in the press room. So, of course, obviously, this has a lot of people speculating about what the future is. So, part of the reason that I really wanted to come here and speak to you all tonight was is because I wanted a reality check and to get away from the hype before we at the Japan Times do something stupid like drop tens of millions of dollars into a Hokkaido operation that's all the way to close in a couple of years, thus upsetting you and us. So again, I'm just kind of posing questions here, stuff to think about. That pretty much concludes it. If you have any further questions or comments about anything that was said or anything that wasn't said, feel free to ask me. So again, thanks for your attention.
Put up the previous slide.
Well, this is a thank you.
Well, put up the previous slide.
Okay. With respect to...
previous slide? Oh, yeah. Sorry, you didn't see it?
Like alternative fuels for transportation. Yeah. There's on the internet, if you type in a Google search and alternative fuels, you come up with quite a few alternatives. Mm-hmm. Was there any talk about hydrogen at all? Or
no, none.
Fuel
none
cells,
whatsoever. No.
Cars,
wave?
Something like that.
No, nothing. The Germans have long said that biomass and wind power are probably the short to medium term solutions for alternative fuels. But no, there was no serious discussion at all on specifics. There was a general sense, as a matter of fact, I might have it here somewhere. But what they basically said was is that we noted the importance of strengthening both research into new technologies and the development of existing technologies. We heard about regional initiatives, including clean coal technologies. That was a big thing. And they said major investment is needed in energy infrastructure the next steps are basically to talk about more investment in alternative energy strategies. So there you go. That's what they agreed to. Yeah. So, obviously the NGOs brought it up. The Germans brought it up. The Europeans brought it up to a certain extent. But part of the problem is that they're associating things like nuclear power and clean coal technologies with alternate energy in the minds of the public. And until they make that separation, you'd see, say, wind, biomass, et cetera, and nuclear power, and clean, because clean coal is still coal. It's still going to put emissions into the atmosphere. You're going to have problems. The other thing that was blocking more discussion on that is Japan has proposed what they're calling the sector approach. Basically, what it means is that they choose eight major industries, including steel, transportation, utility companies, and will tell the industries you must reduce your emissions by X amount over a certain period of time. The steel industry and the utility companies are really fighting this nail and tooth. They really do not want any oversight at all. So Fukuda had to be very careful to what extent he talked about alternative energies, because he wanted to get everybody on board for the sectoral approach issue. If we treated the basic idea of a sectoral approach, then we can talk about what technologies are needed to be introduced to get that sectoral approach. So basically, to answer your question, they didn't get that far. Will they get that far next year in Italy? Probably not. Not with Berlusconi in power. No. But on the other hand, if you have a new makeup of leaders at GA next year that are more interested in talking about this, then who knows. But at this point, Berlusconi told us yesterday that energy was not going to be on the agenda for next year. Next year was going to be climate change, ensuring they get a deal in Copenhagen in December 2009. And he wants to expand the number of countries outside the GA to come to talk about issues, and he will probably issue an invitation to Saudi Arabia and some of the other OPEC members as well to talk about that.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Anything else? Comments, questions, criticisms? Yeah, go ahead.
This hasn't got much to do with summit.
That's all right.
With the Kyoto Protocol, have the countries kept that? Like, keeping to their promise?
Some have, some haven't. Australia has, Russia has, a number of European countries have. Japan has not. Japan would have to reduce by 12% now in order to meet the Kyoto Protocol goals. They're only committed to
60%. So these agreements, I mean, right. I agree, but then if I don't meet them, then what are the consequences?
None. There is no enforcement mechanism. Basically, all you do is, oh, you violated the United Nations Treaty, and there's not really...
Because that's what the Australian politicians are talking about now, you know, the Liberal Party is saying, only if China does it, then we'll do it, so why should we do it first? Because
right.
We'll get a disadvantage.
Right.
So, I mean,
right.
If that just continues, that also continues on, then
right.
There'll never be a resolution.
Right. That's, and part of the problem is who ultimately should be the final arbitrator of a climate change agreement? Should it be the United Nations? Most of the countries say yes, because only the UN has the authority, the experience, and the bureaucratic infrastructure to monitor and to provide assistance and to raise money to help out. The United States and some other countries say not necessarily, because what we need to talk about first is getting the major emitters on board. So it's better for the US, China, India, Brazil, the G8 members to get together in a separate room, work out their own deal, and then take that to the UN and work it out. So, that's called the Major Emitters Meeting. And they met in Seoul a couple of weeks ago, and they met again at G8, and basically nothing was decided. Because it goes back to the issue of the Chinese and the Brazilians in particular are saying, how dare you tell us we can't have our industrial revolution and be as dirty and as messy as you were 150 years ago. To be fair, the Indians are starting to come around. It wasn't noticeable at the summit, but over the past 6 months, India is finally starting to realize that they've got to do something. And so the Europeans I was talking to, the European Commission President Barroso, is fairly optimistic, I think, that by the time the Copenhagen conference comes around, there will be a major compromise on the part of the Chinese and the Brazilians, and the broker of the compromise will be the Indians. So, who knows? But your prime minister is a fluent speaker of Chinese, so maybe he'll have something. Good guy, by the way. I saw him in Kyoto, very informal. Came in with no security, came up to the podium, no introduction, said, hello, everybody, my name is Kevin. And gave a speech. So. Can't imagine any other politician. Anything else that I can do? Yeah, go ahead. Just fire away, Fred, since you're the senpai.
Okay, well, just on the whole post-summit thing, I don't know if this is just my perspective, but I feel like there was a vacant lot. The circus came to town. They set up their tents. Unfortunately, it was an invitation-only circus. I couldn't bring my kids. And then they left. The tents aren't there. It's a vacant lot. And things are back to normal. So I just don't see any post-summit anything. We got our vacant lot back. That's all. If anybody has a more optimistic spin on it, let me know. But that's how I feel.
I miss the police presence.
It was horrible. I had hundreds of police walking in front of my bar, and they couldn't drink. And they were occupying hotel rooms that had potential for tourists who might have come into my bar. So, like, for me, I lost business because of this summit, you know?
It wasn't just you.
Everybody,
all the school kids, you know, I lost so much money.
Oh. People in Toyoko, they lost the most money. Kamori Kanko made a lot of money. Windsor made a lot of money. Yeah. The little Shoten guy, they died.
No.
They died.
Yeah.
Well, this weekend was the Kuchan Jazz Festival.
Yeah.
And I went to my typical Tokyo, I never go to the festival, so I lived there. But it was empty.
Yeah.
Yeah, nobody was going.
Because of security, people.
So the festival was dead.
Have these complaints been made in the local media? Are Japanese people as upset
media.
About this as you all?
They just put up with
it. Yeah.
Does the Japanese press pick up from anything you guys write?
I'm sorry?
Does the Japanese press pick up any stories of you writing?
Me personally, no. But the foreign media, yes. The big thing that caused a lot of anger among the Hokkaido prefectural government officials was something very, very silly and trivial, but perhaps indicative of the sensitivities.
Well,
we in the press, whenever you walked into the main media center after going through the security, you had to take off your belt and your shoes, just like a U.S. airport. Over on the left, they had a booth set up for free media kits. And the media kits consisted of some bag that was not of natural origin, talking about the importance of the environment, a little slogan on the side. A cardboard box of something. I actually didn't get a bag because I try to avoid that kind of thing. And then pens and pencils and a whole bunch of stuff. They were very proud. The Hokkaido government was very proud of the fact that they didn't spend a lot of money on these omiyage for the journalists, because in Okinawa, I think the cost was, each journalist got a free bag valued at something like 15,000 yen worth of goodies. Whereas this time in Okinawa it was maybe 3,000, 4,000. So we saved a lot of money, and it's time at the Compact Summit, which was the way they were selling it down in Tokyo and Kansai. But it was supposed to be an eco bag. You were supposed to be able to save the bag and take it to your supermarket and whatnot. But in fact, it was chemically treated, and it was the... So the Times of London wrote this huge story saying, look how unecological the ecological summit really is. The Mainichi Shimbun picked it up, and they translated it into Japanese. And I was sitting in the press room, and the two Mainichi journalists, along with the Hokkaido government official, came up to me, and I sort of knew one of the Mainichi journalists, which is why he came up to me. He said, he just slams down and said, do you know this guy? And I said, who is it? Terry Ryan something. No, never heard of him. I said, you don't know who he is? I said, no, why? Well, look at this article he wrote. The eco bags are unecological. They spent a lot of money, and this was very careful. We had all these discussions with Hokkaido people, we had discussions with environmental activists, we had discussions with Tokyo, and, look, I said, I don't know this guy. What can I say? What does he look like? I said, 2,000 journalists in the hall. So they were very, very upset. They were very upset. And then I heard later from another journalist that apparently the Hokkaido government was talking about, through Guy Musho, submitting a formal letter of complaint to the Times of London for this. And I said, do whatever you want. Seems to me to be pretty much much ado about nothing. So perhaps that was just the straw that broke the camel's back. They had been tired of hearing from us harping, whining, complaining journalists about how much of a mess they were making the summit, and they just chose this little incident and blew it up. I don't know, but that's...
On that note, NHK had devoted about 10 minutes, I think, on the 7th, the 7 o'clock news, talking about how ecologically sound the media center was, about the cardboard walls, about the snow under the glass.
Yeah, they made it sound like they built the whole thing for the... You know, that Komori built the hotel for the summit. Yeah, that was weird.
They did. They got taken down.
Right. So it's all going to be recycled, is the point. And it's all ecologically sound because, you see, it's cardboard, it's cardboard and tinfoil. Therefore, we have actually we got a little...
Well, on the outside, maybe, but on the inside, it was just used as standard carpet that you can find pretty much anywhere. And the tables were the hard plastic tables that I found that every summer I went to. It was fluorescent lighting. So... yes, the toilets were eco toilets, and they went out of their way to tell us that the water used for flushing the toilets was melted snow. So they were going to do that.
It is anyway, all the water is melted snow, right?
Right, yeah. Well, see, I didn't know what those huge tanks on the outside of houses were until David told me. I said, oh, that's from, oh, okay, right, got it. But they made a big deal about that until again, we started complaining about it. An ecological summit.
I think it's for paying their buddies to build it, right?
Yeah.
That's what it is.
So it was a beautiful press center, and thank you very much for spending your tax money on making my life easy. But to say it was ecological, no, that's definitely over the top. That's definitely over the top.
Did any journalists escape? I was talking to a government
escape?
Official. Yeah, I was talking to a government official about the summit.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, all journalists have been locked up in prison.
So that's pretty much the case. Yeah. What happened is you had basically three kinds of journalists there. You had those with the official delegation. The White House press corps was set up in the Rusutsu. They had the the grand ballroom, and that was just completely full taken over. There were guards. You could go in, but people looked at you funny if you weren't a guard. So I walked in, and I don't know how many of you know the Rusutsu Ballroom, if you've ever been there or not. But there they were. They had set up. There was the speech, and Denno Pellegrino, or whoever it was, from the Bush administration. David Gregory from NBC is over there. I saw a couple other people who I've seen regularly on American television around. And that's where they spent the entire time. Their meals were brought to them, or there was a snack stand right beside. And speaking of ecological, it was the usual plastic bento boxes. So at the end of the day, I'm walking through the press center of the Rusutsu, and there's just piles and piles of garbage, all of these plastic bento boxes that were stacked up. The people with the official delegations were locked up in the press center, definitely. They did not get out, and they didn't get out in Okinawa 8 years ago either. They flew in with the president. They were escorted by the police to the press center, or to the Rusutsu. They stayed there, it ended, and they had to literally rush to Shin-Chitose to get on Air Force One and fly back to Washington. And a lot of the other delegations were basically the same. The second breed of journalists was those who are based here in Japan. That includes the Japanese media as well as foreign correspondents who are based in Tokyo. They had a little bit more freedom. They could cover, say, the summit one day, come to Sapporo to the NGO summit down at the International Convention Center the next day, and then they could go down to the campsites in Tumbetsu or Sobetsu.
So,
thank you. And Date had hang out with the anarchists from Tokyo who came up and were camping out there. So they had a little bit more freedom. And then a third type of journalist avoided the press conference and the IMC completely, and they stayed here in Sapporo, or they went to the campsite where they went elsewhere. And then those were mostly freelancers as well as people who were writing blogs for NGOs, for example. So it depended really on what category of journalist you were. The 2,000 people who were in the International Media Center were, for the most part, local media who had some freedom to get out, but not always. So, whereas, again, the Americans were holed up in Rusutsu. Gordon Brown's delegation was with him in the Windsor, I think. There were a whole bunch of official media types in the Windsor as well. So that's basically what it looked like to me.
So you didn't really have much direct access?
To Bush, none. He gave, he and Fukuda did a presser on Sunday evening, but I was actually here in Sapporo talking to the NGOs, so I missed them. And that was the other thing that drove us nuts, because, as you all know, Rusutsu is a very long way from the Windsor Hotel. The Americans required that the reporters be in position 2 hours before the president's wedding, and it's an hour to the Windsor. So 3 hours before, everybody had to get on one of the buses and go out and go down that road and walk the hill of Windsor and wait. Fukuda and Bush did their little press conference, in which basically Bush said, we haven't forgotten the abduction issue. And that was it. They all got back on. Now, the press conferences at most of these kinds of summits are run like that. So good, bad, or otherwise, that's the thing that everybody's accepted. But what was driving us nuts this time is it was suddenly announced that Fukuda was going to give a 1 minute, count 1 minute, 60 second comment on climate change after a lunch at the Windsor. So, it was the same deal. The journalists had to get to the Windsor 2 hours before Fukuda was due to give his 1 minute press conference, 3 hours total there, 1 minute, get it, an hour back. 4 hours out of the day for 1 minute. And to what really angered us was, without telling us, the Japanese government decided to broadcast it on closed-circuit TV within the press center, so there was no reason to go. But the journalists who went didn't know this when they went. So that was not very nice of the guy who showed to pull that into the stunt box, but that's what they did. So whatever, one of the things that I think a lot of us in the press group got asked is, have you seen Hokkaido? What do you think? Japan, da, da, da.
And what do you mean, what do I think of Japan? It's around like 2,000 other people locked up, as you said, in a press conference. And in order to go to work, I've got to, I've got to prepare for 4 hours for 1 minute. And that's that was the reality. The other thing that I think that was causing a lot of confusion is there were all the pensions in Niseko, of course, had Mongen deadlines. And they weren't used to the fact that a lot of us had to come back at maybe 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. So I would leave at 7 o'clock and I wouldn't get back until 1 a.m. And the owners, I think, were disappointed because I think they were hoping that we would be shopping in the local Miyage stores that are there. If you know where the Niseko Welcome Center is, I think there were a lot of people there who were really hoping that before we left, we would at least drop by and buy a few things. We didn't have time for that. I mean, we'd be back at 1 a.m. and up at 7, and boom, we're gone. So the pension I was staying at in Niseko, they were saying, we didn't see any economic impact at all. No. As a matter of fact, the pension I was staying at, I guess they had massive cancellations because there were 25 rooms in the pension, and I was the only person staying.
Good God.
Yeah. So, and I don't, what is the normal rate for a single room at the Niseko Hilton per night? Does anybody know?
Before the recall, we studied for about 12,000 a night.
Guess what?
50,000?
60.
Oh, wow. Jesus Christ.
But we sort of got some boats and we married.
Yeah.
Yeah,
60,000. That's what they were charging in Germany. Now, the problem was is you couldn't call and make a direct reservation. You had to go through Guy Moshe. Yeah. That was the condition that Guy Moshe was putting on the foreign journalists. They said, you can only stay at the Japanese government-approved hotel. There were 6 hotels on the list. Of course, everybody wanted to stay at the Rusutsu, but there was limited space. The second was the Niseko, and then there were a couple of fairly nice onsens over by Moribetsu and that area. But I immediately said, well, what about the pensions? What's going on with the pensions? We in Tokyo, to be fair, we really tried. And this is the thing that I think I may have spoken to David once or twice about this, but we just didn't have any information on the pensions and the kind of services that I know some of you are involved in.
You're asking me.
we just didn't know. And I think that really, of all the things that will be remembered by the journalists and those who live here and who came here, I think that's the thing that we can't forgive the most, is the fact that there were lots of cheap pensions available and campsites and campgrounds, which in fact the free buses did stop at. Right, very close to the Rusutsu, there's what that's place, the Italian villa or something, there's an Italian flag there, and there's little camp villas and those kinds of things. Those were going for something like 1,500 yen a night. And nobody was staying there, and there was a bus that was stopping right there. The police were not stopping you. As long as you had your official press badge, you could get in. And yet, those who wanted to stay there didn't have any information. And when you call Guy Moshe, oh, well, the Hilton's open, but 60,000 yen a night. So, that really was a tragedy. And I don't know why.
Why? What do they do now?
I'm gouging us, I guess, because a lot of the journals coming in were paying for it out of their own pocket, that their companies weren't paying for it, and that because it was a G8 summit, they could do it and get away with it. So.
Yeah, but
and
they did. Any of the big hotels that benefit and no one else.
Exactly, yeah. Reuters had, the wire sheets, they had, I think they had close to 60 people staying at the Niseko. So 60 people at 60,000 in a night. So that's a lot of money for one company, but Reuters could afford it. That was, the other thing that I think we were a little surprised at, we couldn't have taken advantage of it even had it been offered, but still surprised it wasn't on, it was homestays. So, because in Okinawa, for the Okinawa summit, the Okinawa community said, look, if there's any journalists or NGOs who need a place to stay and don't have, they come all this way. And we didn't hear anything from the Japanese government about whether or not there were going to be homestay possibilities either right before or right after the summit. So, and again, back to the point about local businesses. Even if, for example, Fred couldn't have set up in the press center, I still don't understand why the Japanese government was so pig-headed that at least you couldn't have put out a few brochures or like maybe a map on, hey, if you're in Sapporo, drop by, here's where my establishments are. Or, hey, if you need information on, say, trekking in Asahikawa or whatever, you can call this person or this person. In other words, I don't understand why it was so controlled. Because even in Okinawa, there was that information available. So yeah,
that's easy. Floodgate mentality. If you let somebody in, if you let Fred in, then everybody's going to want to. Everybody's going to want to have their table space. And we can't handle that amount of demand.
Right.
It's probably the mentality.
The other thing that the Japanese government really should have given more thought to, one of the issues, as I pointed out in my presentation, was the food crisis. Now, thank you very much for subsidizing my meals at Oktoberfest and the sushi restaurant in the Rusutsu Resort Hotel, but the fact of the matter is that a lot of us were very uneasy about gouging ourselves on gourmet meals and writing critical stories about the G8 leaders gouging themselves on gourmet meals as they talked about dealing with the food crisis. And we were given all this free food, and I think I speak for the majority of journalists I spoke to, saying that had, for example, Fred showed up, or had any of you who own businesses and restaurants showed up, and charged us for money, we would have gladly paid. It's not a problem. I mean, we have expense accounts, and as long as you're not gouging us like the Seiko Hilton was gouging people, we have no problem paying. But no, the Japanese government, the foreign ministry in particular, said we have to offer free food to the journalists because that's what was done in Germany last year, that's what every G8 summit has done. And, okay, great, but the fact of the matter is that if you're going to talk about food, food crisis, then you shouldn't be giving us four or five star meals. You shouldn't be giving the journalists four star meals, but they did. So, anyway, lessons learned.
It seems that the journalists stated 2,000 people just sitting around and probably being fed something. Well, not food, but actually news. Doesn't strike you as journalism?
It's not journalism, it's reporting. And that's the difference between journalism and reporting. We report it. We report it. You can only do real journalism in a situation where you have easy access to the decision makers and to the people who are actually going to be getting things done. You don't have that at G8 Summit. What you have is you have a very controlled event that's heavy on security and a very, very tight schedule. And a lot of what I did and a lot of what everybody else did was confirm the obvious and checking the little stuff, making sure that facts and figures were correct, making sure that if the NGO said one thing that there was scientific about, making sure that if the leaders said something, we had it down correctly. But with roving deadlines, and with the internet age now, a lot of us had to blog. So I had to file, I had five deadlines every day. And sometimes my editor would call me and say, we need you to send up 600 words on the G8 leaders' political situations at home, and we need it 2 hours from now. So now how are you going to do that? You can write your own opinion, and you very often end up doing that. But you've got to back that up with facts and figures somewhere, and that takes time. Meanwhile, as you're doing research on the internet, as you're running around, you have literally, I'm typing, and an NGO comes up, says, come to our press conference, and then they walk off. It's like, okay, is this important? Do I need, no? Okay. So basically what you're constantly doing is filtering information. And of course, let's not even talk about the telephones ringing constantly, or there's a rumor going around in the press room that so-and-so will do a press conference, so you got to chase that rumor down, or there's a rumor that there's been a new development, say the leaders have made a decision on this, and this media is reporting that, this media is reporting that, so you got to go check it both. Yeah. So it's checking constantly. And that's reporting. So whereas journalism is taking all those facts and distilling them into something that's readable. The great difference between journalism and reporting, I always say, is good reporting asks who, what, where, when, and how. That's what great reporting does. Great journalism goes one step further and asks why. And at a summit like this, you don't have time to ask the why question.
One of the things up there is about news pages.
Exactly.
Perhaps the model needs to change a little bit.
I thoroughly agree with you, and we're trying to change it, but it takes time. And when you're in a frenzied press room with 2,000 other people, even the strongest individual personality has problems resisting the flow of the mob mentality, as it were. Which is why my job to this time was to report as opposed to just kind of analyze and step back. But to be fair, there were some media, specifically a guy by the name of Charles Hanley from Associated Press. Those of you who know Asia, many years ago, Associated Press wrote a story on the massacre at Nobunri Bridge during the early days of the Korean War in the U.S. military. But Charles Hanley was the one who got the scoop. He's also the guy who analyzed the Judith Miller reports in the New York Times about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He was the one who discovered that, in fact, the famous source called Curveball was this fraud who didn't know anything at all about Iraq. He's considered a very prominent reporter. He actually avoided the press. This gets back to somebody's question earlier about when we just logged in. No, Charles showed up just to kind of check, okay, all right, and then he left. And he would go to a private room, call people he knew, and track information down. And he did some good reporting. There was a woman from the New York Times there as well, who was not with the White House press delegation. And I sat in several press conferences with her, and she was asking some really, really good questions. And so I think maybe she did some good reporting. But on the other hand, the White House press person from the New York Times was just, what did Dan Pellegrino, what did Bush say to that? That's it, that's all. It's about 8:20. Perhaps we should wrap things up. I will take one last question.
Your question right there. Nobody's
yes.
really mentioned. Is there a demand for visiting for any?
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, can you give me a one-word answer or a two-word answer, or is it a long story?
Well, basically, it's like my news comes from Tokyo. I get to hear Tokyo news. The communication we have here among businesses. You keep asking. You know, what do we hear about this or this from the Japanese government, or Hokkaido government? And I'm like, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So there is not much communication.
Not much.
I feel that there is a need, but is it enough to support, you know, big, like, Japan Times coming in? I don't know.
Yeah, numbers it gets down to, and as Fred was saying, we basically have to triple. From what I'm hearing. So I guess the question is the market here for 20,000 readers of the Japan Times? And I know that's just a rhetorical question. So, but if anybody has any thoughts on it.
I can give you figures. It's 1.6 average non-Japanese population in Japan. Ours is 0.8, and that's a slight increase over the past couple of years.
Right.
When it comes to English language readers, we're a bit higher than one would expect. I think our fourth largest non-Japanese group is Americans, and that's quite unusual.
Right.
But was it a big enough thing to whet your business appetite? I don't know.
Okay, well, that's an honest answer.
How about expanding the newspaper you have already and putting in a section on Hokkaido?
We used to do these regional sections, and
yeah.
I'm not quite sure why we don't do them anymore.
Money.
well, no, they've got actually the money to do it if they wanted. It's not that expensive. But actually that came up at our Nomikai last night with other Japan Times reporters. And somebody brought that up. Maybe it's time to do some, not just Hokkaido, but Sapporo, and then maybe the Toyokoden and Hakodate, and the different parts of Hokkaido.
Where is your newspaper printed?
Normally, it's printed in Tokyo and Osaka at the Asahi offices, or with the Asahi has different, like Keidetsu or Kogaisha, and so we have contracts with them, and they print it. So this time for the summit, it was printed here in Sapporo at the Hokkaido Shimbun's headquarters, and then it was delivered by their people to the summit venue.
I was saying, in Tuesday's paper, along with your article, there was a great article on Hokkaido's history, and I thought that kind of...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That was in today's paper?
That was on Tuesday's paper.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Well, thank you. I'll pass that along. Yeah. That's great.
So then there's history kind of articles, that's what...
Something Hokkaido focused.
Right, yeah. We were kind of wondering if maybe you all would be interested in more the environmental angle and whatnot. Maybe that's just because our first image of Hokkaido was
I think any green. Information at all about Hokkaido would be welcome, period.
Now, you know the Hokkaido Shimbun during the summit ran an English
yes,
paper.
Yes, I saw that.
I didn't see it. Was that anything?
It was surprising. I poached two articles. Poached and were being recorded. I borrowed two articles, three actually, from the English language version because I was impressed with it. It gave actually a few angles on there that I wasn't expecting. Mm-hmm. They're up on my blog.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It was quality.
All right then. I'll be around, so if anybody wants to come up and ask me questions, but anyway, thank you very much for your attention. It's great to be here. I do love Hokkaido. It's something like my 13th or 14th time here. Let me preempt the question. Yes, I have been here in the winter, although I haven't seen snow yet. So, okay. Again, thank you. And thank you, Craig, for having me.
Okay.
Do we have any EVA announcements?